I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. And starting just a few minutes late, I apologize. It was hard getting through the hall today for some reason. I'm going to start out with a public hearing on House Bill 2212. So I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2212. Bob, would you give us a little information about this bill, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2212, as soon as my laptop cooperates with me here, I apologize, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2212 increases the maximum amount of procurement that qualifies as a small procurement under the Public Contracting Code from $5,000 to $10,000.
Thank you. And I think I'm going to call up Cheryl Myers and Diane Lancaster first. Trying to gauge who should talk first. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby, Cheryl and committee, Cheryl Myers from the Governor's Office.
And Diane Lancaster from the Department of Administrative Services.
So, Cheryl, why don't you start first?
Okay. I think Diane has some written testimony as well. But really, the pieces that I wanted to share is that we are in favor of this bill. There are a number of pieces there that Diane has also noted that the number hasn't changed in 16 years. And so the amount that you can actually purchase with $5,000 has diminished dramatically, and that the ability to reduce paperwork and efficiencies, not only internally with staff who are certainly doing more with less, but also externally for small businesses to respond. From the world of my policy arena, the ability for an opportunity for small businesses and certified firms to engage initially on a very small contract, but not have it be under $5,000, have it be under $10,000, just gives them a little more capacity. So those are things that I think are really very favorable. The other part is that in working with our agency directors, with our procurement advisory team that is formed, I feel confident that this will be a very, very good measure for small businesses, certainly around the state. As we look at the rural component, there's not as much, I guess, assistance available, technical assistance, and so the ability to respond and be negotiating a direct award of this size, I think, is really helpful as well. So to engage local businesses, I feel really good about that.
Great, thank you.
For the record, Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. I've shared a written piece which basically lists these same facts. We found that the dollar, and this is, I don't know if it's depressing or not, but the purchasing value of the dollar, it now would take over $7,000, about $7,173 and some change, to replace the purchasing power of that $5,000 that was enacted 16 years ago. And Cheryl has mentioned some of the reasons that we think this will be provide some flexibility for agencies. And I would not underestimate the flexibility out in the field in Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, where many of our field offices and state agencies are located and have a variety of needs. At the bottom of the written piece, I footnoted agencies that I've had personal contact with, and you'll hear from some of those agencies today. I've also attached, because the military department could not attend today, they provided some written notes that I've attached at the back back of my my own written testimony for your interest. This does not diminish any of the current requirements for posting to and letting the governor's advocate know about contract potentials for certified women, minority, and emerging small business firms, and all other transparency disclosure features are in place. So I'll be available for any questions that you would have.
Great, thank you. Sounds relatively straightforward. Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, not a question, but a comment. I concur with the statements being made. This will be a great bill for small business and small business in Eastern Oregon. Thank you for bringing this forward.
You're welcome.
Great. Other questions? Well, I'm going to chime in with a comment, too, then. I think this is a good bill. I think it also has the impact, perhaps, and maybe you can comment to that, of making our contracting agencies a little more efficient and able to move forward a little bit quicker on some of these smaller items that will end up costing the state a little bit less money because of the cumbersome process they may otherwise have to go through.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, if I could just chime in and underscore that. Some of the stories that I have heard, you know, it's just like it is at home. It's going to reduce the number of trips to the store for a lot of these agencies who are out purchasing, you know, repair trucks, maintenance crews. You know, they go and get building supplies and whatnot. And it's just going to cut down on some of that.
That's kind of what I was thinking in my mind when I was looking at this bill, was actually going to the hardware store or something. There is one part of the bill that actually contains the one of the changes, and I was just kind of curious about it because it does say that the a contract awarded, and I'm looking at the very first section, in the last sentence of subsection 1, actually, that a contract may be amended to exceed this amount only in accordance with rules adopted under 279A. So I'm curious, is that something that's happened in the past, or, I mean, how does that work?
Certainly, Representative Holvey and members of the committee. What that means, 279A.065 is the Attorney General's model rule statute. So what this means is that they will create any sort of flexibility that is needed in order to amend a contract. So, for example, if someone is purchased some services and a little bit more is needed, what is a reasonable amount of amendment that still keeps this particular small procurement threshold within reasonable limits? It never exceeds 20%. And the Attorney General, this has been a long-standing role of theirs, is to sort of make that determination.
So it's put in place basically to add flexibility to a particular agency that may have some nuances to it that, within reason, they get Attorney General to give it an okie dokie, so to speak.
Yes, actually, Representative Holvey, members of the committee, the Attorney General will set that out in rule, and they'll do that after session. You know, if this bill is passed, mm-hmm. they will consider that in their next issuance of model rules, which you have required them to do within 180 days of sine die, and they will, as a matter of course, include some nod towards, okay, small procurement, what is the reasonable amount of amending that should be allowed? So agencies don't have to go there every single time, sir.
Great, great. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that clarification.
You're welcome.
Just answers a question in my mind. And any other questions for this panel? Thank you so much for presenting this bill and kicking it off the day for us.
More than welcome.
Thank you for your consideration.
Up next, we have Shannon Rand and Clyde Sakey. I hope I got Clyde's name right this time. Oh, jeez. It's taken me a few years to get it right. But.
Sure. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon Rand, and I'm the Procurement Risk and Property Director with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm here today to show our support for this bill. There's several reasons that this really will benefit our agency. Primarily, the biggest one relates to some of the discussion here related to small business. We're a decentralized agency. We have a presence in every community throughout the state in one way or another. And allowing the folks in the field to be able to better know their community because they're able to see what's available. $5,000 doesn't buy a lot. So they typically end up going through a bid just to make sure that we don't exceed that. So then there's a cost in the agency staff of doing that as well as on the proposers or bidders for preparing a response. So really, this helps in multiple ways. It gets us out into the local community. My agency supports small business out there in the world. We have a lot of issues where Klamath Falls project ends up being a contract awarded to a firm in Portland. And that doesn't sit real well with stakeholders. They want to keep some money in their community. Mm-hmm. And so we work really hard to find ways to do that. This would give us some additional flexibility and making sure that we can make best effort to keep the money where it should be. We've done some outreach to rural, actually all of Oregon. We went through a outreach through the governor's office, MWESB program, sent a letter out, let them know about the opportunities, how the department contracts, trying to increase some awareness. Got some really good results out of that. 9% return on all of the letters I sent were certified through that process. And so, you know, we are working on making sure that the community knows that's important to us and that we support the local business. It would also allow for a much more streamlined and efficient process. It would take staff that would typically have to spend the time doing the bid, as I mentioned, or the proposal. That takes it out of it. You have an immediate need, you can go take care of it. For example, even though when there is a fire, we're under a declared emergency of some kind typically, in those instances where you're in a heavy fire season, there's no fire burning, but you got to have your truck ready to go, you break down and it's going to cost $8,000 to fix it because nothing's cheap these days. We would have to figure out how we get it done and as quickly as we can to be prepared. You can't really declare an emergency under rule. It doesn't fit that requirement. And this would give us the flexibility to say, okay, we're going to take it and get it fixed and be ready to go again. And I guess, you know, the other thing I would mention, I briefly touched on it. I really do believe that this will show lower pricing when we go out and we talk to the folks in the community. When they have to prepare a bid or proposal, it does cost them a decent amount of money. And so I think that when something between $5,000 and $10,000 comes before us and we say to Joe Smith's Auto Shop how much is, you know, the bid or the price going to be, they aren't going to have to pad it with the cost of their staff time to, you know, cover their overhead for actually responding. I think really overall we really support this. It's important to me to be able to figure out easier ways for my agency to be able to do what they need to do in a timely manner, and I really believe that this bill would offer a lot of opportunities. Thank you for the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Why don't you go ahead, Clyde, and then we'll see if there's any more questions.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Oregon Department of Transportation. We're also here today in support of the bill. Just, I think, for three reasons. I don't want to really kind of repeat things that have already been said. But I think the point that the limit has not been raised since 1997. So the $5,000 limit is really in 1997 dollars. And inflation and increase in costs of materials and services have really limited the amount of things that fall under that $5,000 cap now. And Chair Hovey, as you kind of brought up earlier, once we get over the $5,000 cap, a whole process kicks into place, which takes a lot of time, staff time, and quite honestly, contractor time to reply to these procurements. And I would submit to you that some contractors may not bid on things because of the process they have to go through and not having the staff to be able to resource that effort. We typically use the small procurement or the small procurement process for low-risk items that are primarily purchased out in the field, especially in the rural areas when we need to get something right away. For example, if we have something on a highway or an approach to a bridge, this gives us a vehicle to be able to contract quickly and get the work done as quickly as possible, which oftentimes is a safety issue. And I think that people have talked about this, but I think it's very true that really what it does for ODOT is it increases our flexibility and our capacity to deal with local vendors, especially out in the rural areas. And so I think that's just another benefit of the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And up next, I have Brian Smith and Stacy Cowan. And we'll let Brian go first.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee today. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. And I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. Public purchasing staff across the state provide an outstanding value every day to the citizens of the state and their public agencies. We're constantly looking for ways to do more with less, and we're able to accomplish this through a variety of methods: greater cooperation among agencies, process improvement, automation, and rule changes. This change in the small purchase limit would allow us to more effectively use the purchasing tools that we have in place, whether that's P-cards, direct pays, branded marketplaces like Orpin and the one we have operating in Multnomah County. And it would allow greater efficiency from a transactional perspective, primarily fewer purchase orders and more direct pays. And I'd like to speak specifically about the effect at Multnomah County, to give you a little perspective there. And looking back over the past year, had this change been in place, Multnomah County would have realized at least $6,000 for the year in transactional savings. And that's primarily purchase orders that would have been avoided by going to direct pays. And I believe that this change to the small purchase limit will help us be more efficient without compromising the integrity of our public purchasing system. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Seeing any. Stacy, your turn.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Stacy Cowan with SEIU, and we just wanted an opportunity to get on record some of the concerns that we actually have about the bill. We talked a little bit about the increase in price since 97, so just to point out, the CPI since 1997 has increased by 43%. The bill does represent 100% increase. Our biggest concern is just with the increased level of discretion at the management level. We feel there's consequently a loss of accountability and transparency in the contracting process. We just feel that we should be, whenever possible, being as accountable and as transparent as possible. And again, that's just our main concern about the legislation.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Stacy, not to put you on the spot, but what do you think would bring a little more transparency to this bill other than, you know, the if we took the price issue away?
I just think our preference would be if the committee were interested in raising the limit, that we would just stick to the rate of inflation, which we said was about 43%, so that would bring it to about $7,000, just slightly over $7,000, I believe. I think that if we're interested in an efficiency of the process, I wasn't necessarily prepared to speak on this today, but I think that there are other things that can be done in the contracting process, such as automating the process. I think there are other efficiencies that can be had. I think whenever we're spending taxpayer dollars, the process, you know, even though it does involve several steps, it's there for a reason, so that we make sure that we're getting the best value for the dollar, and that we make sure that, you know, that we're as efficient as possible with the dollars. So I'm not sure if that.
Okay, well, we'll talk some more about that, I'm sure. Any other questions? Not seeing any. I really appreciate you bringing your concerns forward as well, and I appreciate, Brian, you giving us a county perspective as well. So thank you very much for your testimony today. With that, I am going to close the public hearing for House Bill 2212, and I'm going to stand at ease just for a couple of minutes. I'd like to bring the hearing room back to order for the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Thank you very much for your patience. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2652, and Representative Doherty and Fagan. Bob, would you give us a little introduction to this bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2652 prohibits a contracting agency from utilizing a contractor for services if the contractor uses a contact center located outside the United States to perform all or part of the contracted services. Defines a contact center, becomes operative January 1st, 2014, and the bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you for that, and representatives, welcome to the committee from that seat.
And, I had a long haul.
And so if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you very much. Representative Margaret Doherty from House District 35, Tigard in Southwest Portland. And for the representatives and Chair Holvey, we're here today to talk about a bill that will help create and protect local jobs. That bill is House Bill 2652 that will require that contracting agencies don't contract with out-of-country call centers, that they are here in the U.S. The bill is important because outsourcing has become a major component of the call center industry. We need to make sure that when we spend our taxpayer dollars that they aren't being sent out of the country, denying Americans those kind of jobs. We need to work to make sure that we concentrate our resources on where they can do the best for our state and our country, and I urge the committee to pass this bill so we can move forward with the leverage to resource and resources to create more jobs.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. I come today to also testify in support of House Bill 2652. One of our highest responsibilities as legislators is to create an environment so that businesses can hire more workers and create jobs right here in the U.S. And I believe that in fulfilling that responsibility, the very least that we can do is to make sure that public agencies are not spending our tax dollars to create jobs out of the U.S., but that we're using those resources to create jobs right here. So I testify as a co-sponsor of House Bill 2652. which, as Representative Doherty already said, making sure that our public agencies are not using tax dollars to contract with foreign call centers. This bill is a small but real step towards our responsibility of creating jobs and making sure that Oregonians can bring home paychecks. I urge the members of the committee to support this bill and make sure that Oregonians' tax dollars are spent to create Oregon jobs.
Thank you. Open for questions?
Questions?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just prohibits out of country, not out of state. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, that's correct. But certainly the idea would be that, you know, many of these would be Oregon jobs as well.
But it is just U.S., stay in the U.S.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just follow up on Rep. Kenny Geyer's line of reasoning or questioning, too. There's no guarantee that what you would do would actually create any Oregon jobs. You're just saying within the confines of the United States, correct? That's the permissive venue location within view, correct?
Well, there's no guarantee that there would be strictly Oregon jobs, but I think that if you look at what Oregon has been like lately, and if you look at the call centers down in the Prineville area with Facebook and some of these other areas we're now, and some of the Google in the Dalles, is that we are kind of getting the reputation that, one, we have a good workforce, we have got different programs for businesses to come in and to relocate here, and a lot of those, and some of those have been call center jobs. And so I think we're a little more attractive maybe than some other states, but it's the idea of keeping it here in the U.S.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up. Do you have any idea what sort of resources financially that are agencies, I guess, procurement agencies currently invest, or what kind of dollars we're talking about right now that get allocated to potentially outside of the U.S. call centers?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Piggybacking on Representative Johnson's, I just wonder about, it would be helpful to have some numbers, because in the CRC proposal that we just did, we gave preferential contracting to U.S.-made products as long as it didn't go above 25%. So we're balancing trying to create jobs and yet in the government trying not to spend too many resources. So I just wonder if there's some nuance in there.
Representative Lively?
So first, I'm supportive of what you're attempting to do, but having worked in call centers for a lot of years and unfortunately been involved in moving many of them to India, part of my concern about this is at the point the contract can be let, the call center might very well be in the United States and employs the United States, but I know what happens in call centers. Quickly, that changes, and it might become that the same calls that were going to the call center in the U.S. with U.S. employees is now being handled overseas, because many call centers have operations in multiple locations. Mm-hmm. So then the question I have about then, is there some provision in this or about the contract continuing that if indeed that happens? I worked in call centers. In 6 months' time, you would move calls from the United States overseas and back. And so I'm just concerned. It goes back to pricing. Part of it's driven by pricing, what the best price is. But I certainly understand and appreciate what you're doing. I support the intent to do that.
Representative Thatcher.
My question was asked. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? So I too, think this is a pretty neat idea. And I'm curious, you know, I would suppose that, and maybe Shamia would be able to answer this, that we're not running into any issues with the federal government from, you know, blocking somebody from out of the country to take these jobs on because it's specifically about Oregon's public contracts.
Chair Holvey, not being a constitutional lawyer, I can obviously expound on the constitutional I believe that we might run into problems if we were from the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, if we were to require Oregon versus non-Oregon.
Right.
But I'm not aware of any provisions of our Constitution that prohibit us from requiring U.S. jobs.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's one of the reasons it's as expansive as it is.
That's kind of what I assumed. I just wanted to know if that's what the conversation was about that. So, and I'm certain that we could get a more specific answer from Legislative Council if we wanted one. So, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Well, along that line, too, is it legal to do preferential for Oregon? I don't know the area, this area of law at all.
Without
prohibiting?
I'm not going to give you my 2 cents worth because that's what it would be. So,
dictionary dollar, 3 cents.
But I think we this would be my intent to ask Legislative Council some of those questions, perhaps, as we have a few different bills that are dealing with preferences this session. So with that, thank you so much for bringing this interesting bill forward. And we'll take it under advisement and see how the conversation goes.
Thank you very much for your time.
I see. Actually, no one else signed up for House Bill 2652, so it looks like it has no opposition at this point, that is public anyway. And so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2652. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2127. Bob, could you give us a brief description of House Bill 2127?
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2127 requires that a bidder on public improvement contract provide health insurance to the bidder's employees for a period of 2 years prior to submitting bids as a component of the determination of responsibility. The bill exempts bidders who employ 25 or fewer employees and bidders that have been in existence for less than 2 years. The bill would apply to contracts entered into or advertised after the effective date. The bill becomes operative January 2nd, 2014, and there is an emergency clause on the bill.
Thank you. I'd like to call up first John Mullis. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is John Mullis. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Building Trades Council, and I'm here this afternoon to testify in favor of House Bill 2127. As we all struggle with how to get more folks into health care coverage, whether it's through the Affordable Health Care Act, through Cover Oregon, and we're all trying to deal with ever-rising health care costs, this bill seems like a part of a common sense fix that would address part of the problem that's out there. Under the current state prevailing wage law, if a contractor doesn't provide health or pension benefits to their employees, they're then required to pay the equivalent amounts to the worker on their paycheck. But there's no requirement for the worker to go out and get health insurance or pension coverage. And that can result sometimes in the workers having to go on a government health plan, or worse yet, get their health care through the emergency room, which is the least efficient and most expensive way to deliver health care, and both of those methods cost all of us money. Oregon law currently requires certain obligations of contractors to be responsible bidders. They have to register with the Construction Contractors Board. They have to obtain workers' comp coverage. They have to get business licenses in the jurisdictions that they work in. They have to post bonds for the projects that they're working on. And we think adding health insurance to that list of requirements to be responsible bidders is a responsible thing to ask. Currently, the members that work in our council work and have their health care provided for under Taft-Hartley multi-employer funds that we run in cooperation with our employers. And they work very, very well. They allow for portability for the employee to move from employer to employer and not lose their coverage. They all get family health care coverage under these plans. And the benefit to the employers is that they are able to offer really top-notch benefits to their employees and keep them on staff and on board for the next project that's bidding a week from now or a month from now, so that they can have retained good people and perform the next job successfully and turn a profit on it. Unfortunately, not all construction contractors offer health care coverage. We had a meeting 2 days ago with Rocky King and some of the Cover Oregon staff at their offices in Durham, and just talking about how our Taft-Hartley funds are going to fit under the Cover Oregon plan. And we're still a ways out on their radar screen, because right now they're struggling with how are they going to get 550,000 uninsured Oregonians into the system. So we think this bill would help with that problem. You might hear from some of the opponents that they can't afford to offer health care. I don't believe that, frankly. I believe it's just that they choose not to. So again, I'm here in favor of this bill and appreciate the opportunity. Do my best to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were saying in the beginning that if they didn't offer a health insurance plan, they had to have cash. And yet there are some concerns that they can't afford it, and yet they have to offer cash. So what is the cash equivalent? How does that compare to the health insurance that they would have had to buy? It's not the same amount, clearly.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer. Currently, the way that the rates are posted in the prevailing wage book is it shows the hourly rate for a bricklayer mm-hmm. and the fringe benefit amount. Mm-hmm. And that's what our employers pay. If an open shop contractor gets a project that doesn't provide fringe benefits, then they just put that money on the check. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, then it doesn't provide health care coverage for the workers.
Other questions? I have a quick follow-up to that. So I would assume that it doesn't provide that health coverage, because when those workers aren't on a prevailing wage job, they don't get that little fringe benefit amount to cover health care.
Chair Holvey, that I can't say for sure, but that would be my guess and observation from spending my life in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. I actually came to a different conclusion, so I'll try it out as well. Could it be that they were part-time, and that's why the fringe benefits associated with the actual wage is less than what an insurance policy would be? Has that happened in your industry as well?
Chair Holvey, Representative, can you restate the question again? I'm not sure.
So the fringe benefit is associated with the wage that they're paid, and if they're part-time, maybe the fringe benefit is less, the cash is less than it would cost to buy an insurance, health insurance plan.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, our contractors that are signatory to collective bargain agreements pay the wage rate and the fringe benefit on all projects that they work on, mm-hmm. whether they're public or private. I don't know what the practice is in the open shop. I don't know if they, when they work on private jobs, if they pay their workers the same amount that's posted in the prevailing wage law. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
And I might make a stab at your question, because I think I heard it a little bit differently. A part-time worker on a public works project would still get paid the same amount and the same fringe benefit amount uh-huh. for the time they work, because it's on an hourly basis.
Uh-huh. That's correct. And if I misunderstood, I apologize.
Representative Thatcher.
And adding on to that, if they are truly part-time, that fringe benefit might not add up to what a monthly premium would be.
That's what
and
I
so
was trying to say.
There are programs that they can bank their hours so that once they accumulate enough, then they are covered. It's kind of a weird deal, but yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Other Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment, first of all, I guess I'm curious as to why Building Trades feels it's part of the responsibility to try to recruit for OHP. It sounds like that's what your purpose here, but I'll go into my question. But if the purpose of the fringe, okay, let's just say, let's follow your line of reasoning here, that we go ahead and mandate that the workers then, the employer then goes ahead and pays the insurance is provided for, would you be in favor then of reducing the fringe accordingly if in fact they can show evidence of providing health care insurance for their employees?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, the fringes are already included in the prevailing wage. So that's just part and parcel of the prevailing wage law. It just depends on how the employer chooses to deliver the total package.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow up. So, in this economy, obviously, companies, some are doing very well, some have been struggling to stay open and ready to be able to bid on contracts, provide services, and so forth. And over the past of the 2 years, there could be a lot of fluctuation in the level of employees that a company can even retain. So this could put some companies in good standing who would love to participate and bid on projects, leave them out of that process if they can't demonstrate that they've been providing this health care insurance for the past 2 years. Do you see a problem or issue they were serving?
Chair Holby, Representative Johnson, we put the 2 years in just to try and assure that they were going into legitimate health care plans. We have asked for an amendment, and I meant to mention this at the close of my testimony, that the requirement for coverage for employees would be equal to or greater to the essential benefits plan provided by CoverOregon. So there's a benchmark in there of the coverage that they would have to provide. And I come out of the Bricklayers Union. I think the definition of a small business is 50 employees or less. And out of the dozens of signatory contractors that we have in the state, I can only think of two or three that might go over 50 in really good times. And unfortunately, that hasn't been the case in the last 4 years. But they've all stayed and all provided health care.
So thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So this is kind of following up to Representative Johnson's question, just to make sure that I'm clear on how this would work. So if they were started providing health insurance, as part of the benefits, then would that reduce the amount of the fringe benefits that they would, or eliminate the fringe benefits addition that they'd have to give in their check, like as cash?
Chair Holby, Representative Vega Peterson, that's correct. Okay. So if I could paint a scenario that might help explain it. So let's say a bricklayer is $30 an hour and $15 in benefits. And if they pay a fund, so that's what our contractors pay. If the open shop would pay $30 an hour and $5 in benefits, then they would pay 10 more on the check.
Okay.
That answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So everybody still has to get to the $35 level.
Other questions, Representative Richardson?
Thank you. I'm interested in the assumptions that are made that's the basis for your argument. Do you have any evidence that indicates that those contractors that are not providing the level of benefits that are going to be required to cover Oregon, that there's a, that their workers go to the emergency room, that their workers are a burden on the taxpayers? I've never heard that before, that there was that relationship between working, laborers or skilled craftsmen, if they don't have coverage that measures a certain level, go to the emergency room as a burden on society.
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, I don't have any specific studies that would say the numbers or percentage of workers that happens to. In construction, a lot of the workforce are young men in their 20s or 30s. They're pretty healthy. They don't get sick very often. So that's not an issue usually. But obviously, if they have an accident and they don't have coverage, then that can, and I don't know exactly what percentage would fall under a plan or go to the emergency room. I don't know for sure, but I know that it happens.
Okay, let me follow up.
Sure.
So when you say have an accident, of course, you're talking about off the job.
Correct.
Because they'd have workers' comp if they were on the job.
Correct.
So the goal of this bill is to ensure that for them to be able to work for a company that could possibly get a job in construction, they, in addition to bidding based on price and quality of work and experience and all those things, they have to provide a predetermined level of insurance benefits to make sure that if they get injured off of their job, that they've got medical coverage. That's basically what we're talking about. Is that right?
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, that's correct.
Okay, just one final thing. As we consider different bills, I think that it's part of our job to look beyond the surface of what's on a bill and say, is this bill really trying to pick winners and losers and stack a deck in favor of certain contractors to the detriment of other contractors? And if that is the case, I think that we need to look carefully at it, because the law should be something that opens the field for Oregonians to compete and not stack a deck in favor of one side or the other, in my opinion. Thank you.
And Chair Holby, if I may, Representative Richardson, just a respectful response. Sure. I would view this as a bill that would level the playing field and try and bring workers that don't have health insurance that are construction workers to some level of coverage like the construction workers that we represent have.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. So we just passed out of the House at least the House Bill 3200, and there are some strong language targeting.
Did we?
No.
Out of the House.
No.
3200 is a gun bill?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. What's that other controversial one?
Who's
I? I have controversial bills on my mind. 2800?
Yes,
2800. A lot of controversy. I'm getting a lot of emails about all of those. So.
I'm going to move away.
And so we had some strong goals around women and minority and small businesses, and I see that this exempts businesses under 25. But I'm assuming that when you talk about public improvement contracts, that that might be in there. I want to make sure. I appreciate the intent of this legislation, absolutely. And I appreciate the intent of the public contracting language in 2800. And bids may go out within 2 years, and some, and I don't know, we've got Cheryl Myers in the audience here, in the audience may be able to answer this, but how many of those groups may not yet be at the place where they're offering health insurance, and because of this law, may then get locked out of that process? Who have between 25 and 50 employees?
Right. And Chair Holby, Representative Kenny Geyer, we're willing to talk about that two-year requirement.
Okay.
So, you know, I want to make a couple of comments, too, you know, just to speaking what Mr. Mullis is talking about. It's and Representative Richardson brings up an interesting point, but I think that the prevailing wage is set, and it's set on surveys of contractors in the industry, and they establish what a package of a salary or a benefit package looks like, and that's your total compensation. And out of that, they say, well, the average compensation for this insurance plan, which oftentimes is sometimes family coverage, maybe not, but is this much an hour. And so that becomes the standard for people to compete fairly on a project, because it wouldn't be fair for a contractor who has a family health plan, if that happens to be the average, to compete against a contractor who doesn't offer that plan. And so traditionally, from my understanding, the idea that they could pay this in cash at least helps balance that to some degree, but it really doesn't balance it out totally, because the contractors that actually do provide those plans are paying for it whether they're on a prevailing wage job or not. And so they're actually at a disadvantage, those contractors that offer plans, to the ones that don't. And so this bill is really aimed at trying to level that playing field to some degree. If, in fact, we you know, agree with the policy of the state of Oregon that's already been established in prevailing wage law, and I'm just going to reference that policy already exists in statute under 279C, and it states simply that the Legislative Assembly declares that the purpose of the prevailing rate of wage law, and I'll skip a couple of the items, but go down to the one item that's specific to this, states that it's to encourage employers to use the funds allocated for employee fringe benefits for the actual purchase of those benefits, to try to make sure that that playing field is level. And so that, I think, speaks directly to I think, the proponents of this bill, looking at that particular policy and trying to make sure that contractors compete fairly and that they're on a level playing field. And that may spark some interest as well. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I think there are some incentives in place already that would behoove the contractor to go ahead and purchase those benefits, because one, you know, usually their liability insurance is based on the payroll, and so reducing the amount they put into the paycheck reduces the amount of liability they would have to pay. And then also the tax issue, there's just all kinds of good reasons to go ahead and buy these benefits if if you can. I mean, there might be some reasons that some people aren't able to do that yet, but I would say that they're not at a disadvantage.
Another opinion? Any other thoughts on this? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess where I'm aware of a situation where a contractor years ago helped the state devise the RFP for a crane, for purchasing cranes, and it looked like this is really going to be a safe crane, but as it resulted, you know, the way that it was all worked out, there was only one crane that could be purchased, and guess whose company that wasn't provided that crane. And so ever since then, I thought, okay, watch out for stacking the deck in a way that makes it look like it's fair, but in reality, it is going to favor one over another. In this instance, we're not saying we provide health care that's acceptable. It's provide health care that at least meets that which is going to be provided by Cover Oregon, which has a whole series of requirements and so forth. And so you get a contractor who may have a plan with Aetna that doesn't provide every aspect that's covered by Cover Oregon, and now they're unable to compete or to even bid because they would have to go and change their healthcare policy to align with Cover Oregon, and Cover Oregon still doesn't know what its requirements are. They haven't even finalized that yet. And so we're going to be saying, let's go along with something that hasn't even been implemented yet. And so to me, I say, no, wait a second, you know, that can be manipulated. So that's what is a concern to me.
Right, and thank you. I would guess that it would still fall within the fringe benefit requirement under the prevailing wage law, regardless of what plan it would be. So the dollar amount would be set.
So I misheard that.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I can't say exactly what's under the essential benefit plan. I believe that it is scoped out as what the benefits are. I don't know that for sure, but I will find out and I will get back to you. It's my understanding that that's the bare bones, the basic level of coverage. But I'll find out and I'll get back to you.
So with that, committee, I know we really do need to move on, and I know it's a big topic, and we're going to hear some that are from the other side of this argument, and thank you very much for your testimony today. So up next, I have Dave Kutz and Brian Smith and Jan Meekums, I think. Oh, wow. Should mark that down.
Yeah.
Welcome and good afternoon, and I appreciate you showing up to testify on this bill. So if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee. I'm Brian Smith. I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. I would first like to share that I'm supportive of the sentiment of this bill, but I want to share with you my firsthand knowledge regarding how administratively impossible the provisions in the bill would be to implement as they're written in the bill. First, health insurance is available on a spectrum, and the bill lacks any definition of health insurance. The way in which it's written, every type of insurance, from providing a $25 voucher to visit a walk-in medical clinic to a fully comprehensive policy, would qualify as health insurance and be treated equally. Second, without an objective standard by which to measure what does and doesn't qualify as health care, public agencies are exposed to the risk of bitter protest that we acted arbitrarily in determining that they didn't meet this requirement. I dealt with my first protest on this issue in 2010 when Multnomah County first started asking vendors about the health insurance they provide their employees. Third, it's also unclear as to how the new 2014 federal mandates and the Oregon plan would impact this, especially since they take effect at about the same time as this bill. While I'm not an expert on the federal health care changes, I'm concerned that if this bill were to pass as written, we would all spend a lot of effort on legislation and policy, which could be rendered functionally irrelevant because of federal health care changes. Fourth, another issue is defining which employees qualify for this health care requirement. Only full-time employees, part-time, contract, and on-call employees covered? This is critical because it greatly impacts employer costs and therefore bid prices. And finally, I'm concerned about the unfunded implementation cost, as Multnomah County would have to verify that this was provided during the 2 years prior to submission of a bid. This could be potentially onerous, as it is unclear as to what exactly constitutes sufficient demonstration that a bidder has met this requirement. Cancel premium checks, simple sworn statement. And in closing, I'd like to reiterate my support for the issue, but emphasize that the way in which this bill is written, it would be an administrative nightmare to implement. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Why don't we go on to the next testifier?
Chairholder Holvey and members of the committee, my name is David Coots. I am a contractor and a subcontractor, and I'm also here representing ABC. I think he read my notes. I too am concerned about how this bill reads. The word provided is unclear, because we offer insurance to our employees, but not all of them accept it. How does that work? Because they may have insurance through another means. Concerning the two-year verbiage, able to demonstrate is another concern from our perspective. I'm just curious as to what that would look like and the added expense and burden on a contractor to supply that information. And then finally, the Affordable Care Act goes into effect about the same time as this, and we could be spending a lot of time, taxpayer dollars, on a redundancy that we may not even need to implement because of the other, the Affordable Care Act. So I just wanted to reemphasize that.
And thank you. And for the record, you identify yourself with ABC Company?
ABC, Associate Builders and Contractors.
Oh, okay.
I'm a member of. I'm also a subcontractor.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Next up.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jan Meekins, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We represent 7,500 small business owners here in Oregon. Some of our business owners are certainly in the trades, and this bill would affect them. And we have the same concerns that have already been voiced by not just ourselves, but you, Chair Holvey, and other committee members, as far as this creates another mandate. And already healthcare, by polling our 7,500 members in Oregon and 350,000 nationwide, consistently for the last couple of decades have voiced that health insurance is the number one concern, the number one cost driver of our members. So it is a focus for our small businesses, but it's a very expensive benefit to provide. And we feel that this bill would add another layer of regulation, another layer of compliance, another layer of expense. It is unwieldy in the way it's written. As mentioning Cover Oregon, there's the gold and the platinum and the silver plans, and they have several different plans, and I think it would be very difficult. And if you look at the bill itself, on Section D, we're talking about responsibility and to prove responsibility. And Section D says qualifies as a carrier-insured employer or a self-insured employer or has elected coverage. So there is an element that does require health insurance responsibility on the part of the employer. And as has been mentioned, we're coming out of a recession, and it's been a slog, like walking through quicksand for many of our small business owners. And I think what we need to do is to facilitate them instead of make things more difficult for them and add another layer of paperwork and reporting and qualification for their members and for their employees. And because this is, as was probably previously mentioned about prevailing wage and that we're talking about responsibility. The responsibility does go both ways. It is a part on this contracting for the employer to have the responsibility to provide the prevailing wage and include the financial amount of the benefit. But there's responsibility then on the part of the employee then to use that to go out and seek health insurance and not to come up with a punitive piece of legislation that goes back, you have to prove for 2 years and you have to, all the benchmarks that would be added to that to qualify. I think it's just not the right time in the right place or the right bill to help our small businesses get going. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. And we have one more brave testifier signed up on this bill, Mr. Clyde Sakey.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Sakey, Oregon Department of Transportation. And I just have an issue that the department wants the committee to be aware of as you consider the bill. The two-year requirement is in conflict with the Code of Federal Regulations that govern the Federal Highway Administration, and so that could be problematic as far as projects that were being paid for with federal funds. And just to be clear, it's not the health insurance requirement that's in conflict. It's that two-year period that's problematic.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions from the committee? Clyde, before you get up, I have one for you. So, you know, being that you come from the state, I'm going to take a little liberty to throw a curveball at you.
Great.
And I apologize for that ahead of time.
I almost made it back.
So I'm curious, how does, you know, given that the policy of the state of Oregon is to actually encourage the use of that fringe benefit to actually purchase those benefits, well, how does the state or how does ODOT work to achieve that policy?
Well, Representative Hovey, members of the committee, that's a big curveball. You know, I think...
Well, you can just call it a big curveball and say, I'm not prepared to answer that.
I guess what I would say, just working for ODOT, is that we do the best that we can to make sure that our contractors are supported and that they are providing as much benefit to the people who work for them as we can. And as you know, it's a complex issue. It's something we just keep very much on our radar and try to address as we contract for work.
That wasn't a fair question.
I tried to kind of dance around. Didn't do a very good job.
Yeah, I'll probably hear about that question later. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's why I called you brave during the testimony.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify something that I said earlier. For people who are employers who are already subject to paying prevailing wage for most of the wages that they pay, mm-hmm. it is a definite advantage for them to actually purchase the benefits. For those companies that haven't entered the public contracting field yet and really haven't dipped their toe into prevailing wage projects, yeah, I mean, that's it.
Apples and oranges issue. Yes, well aware of that. But at the same time, I know that, you know, as Oregon struggles with its budget and struggles with finding the resources to find health care for people and to get them coverage so that their health care needs aren't at the expense of the state as much as possible, it seems like if we're using our dollars to hire contractors, we would think it would be the good policy has been stated in our laws that we do consider whether or not those people we contract with actually provide that health care. Because if it doesn't, we're contracting with folks that potentially end up costing the state more money in a different part of our budget.
So, you know, I think that's it's something to think about. I know this is a complex and complicated issue, and it's probably going to take a lot more discussion to wade through this one. But I think it's a great discussion. And with that, nobody else is signed up, and I'm not signed up, so I'm going to close the public hearing with House Bill 2127. Where are we at now, Bob? Okay. Now, let's go ahead and open a pub. I'm sort of waiting for another legislator to show up. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2667. Bob, can you give us an introduction to this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2667 creates a task force on procuring through small and local businesses. The bill directs the task force to study public contract awards to certain businesses, including the types of contracts awarded and the methods and potential methods for promoting contract awards to such businesses. Directs task force to evaluate whether a procurement decision may be made based on greenhouse gas emissions from contractor during or as a result of public contract, specifies membership and procedural requirements of the task force.
Thank you, Bob. And do we know who sponsored this bill?
Frederick. Lou Frederick.
Yeah. Oh, is he here?
We are.
Hmm.
Do you want me to text him?
Well, there's no one. Is there anybody that'd like to testify on this bill? I know it's it is an interesting bill through small and local businesses. But so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2667. We'll figure out what to do with it later. With that. Is he here on the
right
one? Okay.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, perfect timing. I'd like to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2667. And people probably look at the calendar and watch the clock and think that I follow the order.
She doesn't.
Actually, hasn't been my MO this session so far.
Thank you, Bert.
So, Bob's already opened up this introduction to this bill, so if you'd like to give us your testimony on House Bill 2667, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and I come here to tell you about House Bill 2667. First, I'm going to talk about the problems we're attempting to solve here. I've often cited the adage that when the economy sneezes, the black community gets pneumonia. That's the saying, but it applies to all minority communities. In the construction contracting world, there are a number of explanations. One, large and established businesses finding less in the way of large contracts start going after smaller ones, leaving nothing for those who are elsewhere on the ladder. Public agencies that let contracts have firms that are accustomed to doing that they are accustomed to doing business with, and those firms are more likely to be notified and be ready to respond when contracts become available. Number three, while over the years several programs and policies have been put in place to ensure that the opportunity to build a business via public contracting is widely available, these programs are notoriously poorly audited, and anecdotes abound of abuses that result in no real opportunity for minority-owned or women-owned or emerging small businesses. When I brought forward a similar bill in 2011, but focused narrowly on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act contracts, the results were frankly appalling. It took over a month to get the data from Business Oregon. MWESB vendors accounted for 9 out of 166 prime vendors, 5.42%, and just 2.46% of the dollar value. Of those who contracted with local governments under the era, just 8 out of 2,696 were MWESB businesses, 0.3% of the vendors and 0.2% of the dollar value. After requesting more detail, I found out that only 4 of a total of 2,862 vendors were identified as minority-owned, and rounding that up, that's 0.14% of the total. Not one of those was black-owned or Asian-owned.
At the time I introduced that bill, Business Oregon argued that they didn't need a bill to compile this data, that they would get it back to me right away. Well, it took them a month to pull together the partial data. It took another 10 days to break it down. The information, when I finally got it, was appalling, frankly appalling. Further, even after providing this information to me, there were claims that made that it really wasn't as bad as it looks, but no hard numbers to confirm that. The thing is this, I hear anecdotal accounts all the time of barriers that minority-owned businesses encounter when trying to do business with the state, whether we're talking about ODOT or Business Oregon or some other agency. Business owners report problems with the proposal process, problems with pre-qualification, problems with the selection process, problems with subcontracting, and problems with monitoring. Some of them report reluctance to continue to spend time on what appears to be a futile effort making proposals. I even hear about shenanigans that businesses employ to circumvent participation goals and requirements. But I'm not accusing anybody of anything here. The point is to produce evidence one way or the other. What I'm arguing is that there are entrenched ways of doing business that are widely believed to disadvantage businesses that are on the way up. If that is not the case, the data should bear that out. If it is, it shouldn't hide in our reluctance to look. I proposed another bill having to do with prompt pay for contracts, subcontractors on public projects. I found out that we already had passed such a bill. We passed it in 2009. When I relayed that information to some of the business owners who had complained to me about delayed payments from prime contractors, they told me this: sure, but if you try to use it, you'll never get any work again. So I think we do need a bill and a mandate to examine our contracting practices in some detail. This is not just a matter of fairness. Business people who describe these problems to me never fail to point out that they are not seeking an advantage or a handout. They are looking for an opportunity to build their businesses by completing work and providing good value. As policymakers, we need to know that the public gets good value, both in terms of work accomplished and of economic benefits and from its construction dollars. And there is another part of the bill as well. It concerns the environmental consequences of certain contracting practices. It asks the task force created by this bill to look at some of the costs that are not currently factored into contracting decisions. The bill doesn't make a finding. It asks the task force to do so. In summary, is there an opportunity to encourage local contracting by making the environmental costs of transporting goods, construction components, and workers a part of the contract evaluation? So, here is what the bill does. It creates a task force. Then it charges that task force to study the current practices regarding awarding contracts to minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses, evaluate whether subdividing large contracts into smaller procurements could help make contracts more accessible to minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses in the state and help them build capacity, study whether transportation associated with construction projects could be reduced and whether that would reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. Evaluate whether incorporating the environmental cost of transportation into the calculation of best value in comparing proposals is frankly legal. Is that legally viable, or whether it would produce good value for the state overall? Investigate other ways to increase opportunities for local, minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses. And finally, make this report no later than September 1st, 2014. The Urban League State of Black Oregon report of 2009 cites cumulative causation. We have to recognize that prosperity is cumulative. Many of the businesses that dominate in construction industries got their start in a very different competitive environment from what we have today, one in which the ladder of growth and the capacity building was wide open ahead of them. Minority businesses aren't looking to leap to the top of that ladder, but they do want access to the rungs and the opportunity to climb. A lot of people talk about how our economic needs just one word, jobs. But that's not the whole story. Jobs does not describe an economy. Growing communities also need businesses and professional opportunities that increase capacity and economic activity at a neighborhood level. We need to increase both employment and the quality of employment. When the state spends money to do work that needs to be done, we need to make sure that our spending is good for our economy at all levels, as well as for the good of the infrastructure that we so badly need. Any questions?
Questions, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Frederick. This is very interesting, Representative. Essentially, you are indicating that there is data that would support the possibility that there's racism in the state as far as the awarding contracts, and that may or may not be the case. If that is the case, it needs to be rectified. Absolutely. When you talk about awarding contracts, makes sense. When you talk about increasing opportunities, makes sense. When you talk about access to the rung of ladders, makes sense. When you talk about, and we also want to know what the influence or the effects of greenhouse gas on transportation costs, you're taking off on a tangent that essentially diverts attention from the true focus of your bill. And that becomes very expensive, very controversial. The cost for the science, you could end up having that one little aspect of this bill consume the cost that would be allocated or the focus of the task force and take them away from these other areas, which I firmly think that we ought to be looking at. And so I just, and as I went through everything you said and I've looked at the bill, I haven't read it in detail, I just think that you may want to not have quite so much in there because it would tend to take a very important issue and research and take it out on a tangent that makes this a controversial partisan bill that hurts instead of helps the likelihood that it goes through.
Chair Holvey and Representative Richardson, the basic concept behind that part of the bill is to talk about, frankly, how we manage to make sure that we are dealing with local businesses. That's the basic concept behind that. I'm not trying to do much more than find a way to, and as I said, really, does this work? Would this help in terms of making sure that we have local businesses? It's difficult because of obviously federal things to say no, you cannot have businesses from other states come in and do this. But I think we can make a case that we can certainly support local businesses if they are in fact providing a service that does not include an increase or a problem with the environment, and that's the approach that we're trying to take there.
Thank you. Other question, Representative?
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In going with the Vice Chair Richardson, I kind of agree with him. I was with you, and I could be with you almost with two bills. It's almost as if we need to focus on one
or the other.
and focus on the other, but separate them. But one thought I wanted to share with you, because I think you're raising a very, very important issue. I would also be looking at the folks who are helping to train and educate about the opportunities available for public procurement and public contracting that we as taxpayers spend money on. Within the Oregon Department of Transportation, within Business Oregon, within that little agency of women and minority emerging small business, within the Secretary of State's corporate division, there's multiple entities that help to educate. And I would encourage you, and I'd love to assist you in this effort, to help bring them on board and find out what are they doing to make sure we're reaching out to all Oregonians. Because I think, I'm very familiar with one of those, and those are the Small Business Development Centers, who receive $1.5 to $2 million a biennium. I wonder why we're not telling them, you will help us reach all our Oregonians. Anyway, so I just want to share.
Chair Holvey and Representative Smith, I know those groups and those folks very well. And quite frankly, they're doing a lot. They've got a lot of education. Their effort is not that they are. It's not that they are not putting out information to the folks. It's on the procurement side. Once they try to get any sort of contracts, that's where things stop. It's not getting that information. I mean, I have a stack of documents from all of those groups that you mentioned, and I'm in meetings with OAMI and with and the African American Chamber of Commerce, right, and all of these folks who get this kind of information. And you have some folks in the back there. I mean, Cheryl has done a remarkable job of getting that information out to people. The real issue then becomes when the procurement takes place. The information is there, and lots of it's there. It's who's making those decisions past that. When I 2 years ago asked for information, I found that people have just stopped applying at a certain point. They would apply. You know, I have a small business myself. It's a bit much for me to call it a small business because I'm not making much money at it right now. But when we try to apply for a position or when we have to fill out an RFP, it takes us a day or two to do that, which means we aren't doing anything else.
Right.
And there's a scale issue that takes place when a larger company has its own department to just do the applications. That's another thing altogether. And you have businesses that once you start doing that and you do it 12 times, at a certain point you just say, all right, enough. I'm just not going to do it. And there are companies that I can. I mean, O'Neill Electric, for example, is a $16 to $20 million electrical company in Portland, owned by a fellow named Maurice Romming. Maurice would tell you that he had jobs in Idaho, in Washington, and Pennsylvania. But he, after applying in Oregon, he couldn't find anything until very recently. And now he started to get those jobs. But it has been for quite some time. So it's that kind of a history that I'm looking at.
Just really quick, Mr. Just very quick.
Okay.
Promise. I hear you loud and clear now. Representative, I hear you loud and clear. And if we can figure out following Vice Chair Richardson's thought, how to really focus on that piece of this. I'd really love to work with you and support you in this.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Yes.
The key thing for me is this. I want to get something together, and the process, this is the process, and I don't have a problem with that process, but I want to get something out there so that we're able to work on it.
Thank you, Representative Frederickson. I actually concur with my colleagues who have spoken about that. I think we're bringing in the environmental and atmospheric, and it really is going to make this a much more difficult thing to address. I understand where you're going with that, but I think we can address that much more directly. And I think we might look at some small amendments and work at moving this bill forward. Because I agree with you. I think there are some issues we need to take a look at and try to identify what those impediments are and try to deal with them head on. So I encourage you to work with us to get some amendments where we can support moving this forward.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2667 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2402. Bob, please give us a quick introduction of House Bill 2402.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2402 prohibits a public body from providing a public subsidy of $750,000 or more for certain contracts unless iron, steel, and manufactured goods used in the project are produced in the United States, and it does provide an exemption process.
Thank you, and we have Representative Witt and Representative Klim here to testify on this bill. And gentlemen, I apologize for the wait. Sometimes things just take a little longer.
You're first.
Which one?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2402, otherwise known as the Buy America Bill. House Bill 2402 requires the use of American-made building products in the construction, remodeling, or maintenance of public works projects whose public subsidies total $750,000 or more. The bill's intent is to bolster American business, increase domestic employment, and lastly, rebuild the economic vigor of our nation's economy. It is my hope and my intent that Buying America will revitalize America. The bill is based on the successful Buy America Federal Act, and has two safety valves. Firstly, American-made building products need not be used when they are not of sufficient quantity or quality. And secondly, when their use would raise the project costs by 25% or more. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2402 is one step in rebuilding America, and I would ask your favorable action in moving this bill forward to those ends. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Klim, before you start, I will note that due to time, we're going to carry over House Bill 2653 to Tuesday. The crowd still has thinned out, so
nice try.
Representative Klim, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Klim, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem. Just we'll touch on one more point that I want to emphasize. This Buy America Act is already in place for any projects in Oregon that are using any federal money. So we already, on many projects, do partner with the feds. This essentially is intended to bring into the Buy America theory of purchasing state-only or state and local-funded projects. And agencies, who work with these, ODOT, those sort of things that work with construction projects are used to doing Buy America analysis, and they know what the off-ramps are. It's the exact same thing that we do on any of these joint big projects that involve federal funds. The goal is just to, again, have it apply when it's a state-only project with the same two off-ramps. Materials aren't quality or quantity readily available, or it's going to elevate the project 25% or more, and that's not a number we pick. That's the Federal Buy America Act of 1933.
1933.
Yeah.
Any questions, the representatives? Representative Wiley.
So, as I read this, so the only question or clarification, I guess, one, it talks about the $750,000 threshold, and it talks about that may be also its direct appropriations or a tax credit or abatement. So this would apply to projects that are private projects. I'm going to go back to tax incentives for economic development projects, I guess is what I'm thinking about. So those where we've provided some tax abatement or tax incentive that's more than $750,000 but is not being funded totally privately.
Chair Holby, Representative Lively, that's correct. It is the amount of the subsidy and not the project cost.
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, I wonder if you considered if this would have any impact on our state's involvement in energy projects and so forth, i.e. Betsy tax credits and so forth, and where do all those components come from? We're talking windmills, we're talking solar panels, we're talking a lot of different things that we provide subsidies for, certainly tax credits, and I don't know that all of those parts that we see going down I-84 on their way out to this guy's neighborhood are necessarily manufactured in the U.S. And likewise, that committee meets in this room in a half an hour, but we've got one of our groups wants to see 250,000 solar panels on homes across the state of Oregon over the next few years, but it doesn't talk about the origin of them. It just says solar panels, and I'm just wondering if, again, that's on a micro basis, not a macro basis, but what impact might this have on our energy subsidies as we try to encourage a more energy efficient Oregon and so forth, working through the Energy Trust of Oregon? And I mean, you've got some pretty good sized projects, obviously, but just for conversation purposes, wondering if that was considered.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that actually was considered, and a couple of things come to play here. First of all, the intent of the bill, obviously, to try and generate increased domestic business. In those instances where some of those blades may not be readily available here domestically, the bill anticipates those kinds of situations where there simply is not access, perhaps, to those specific kinds of building materials, and there would be an exemption under those kinds of circumstances.
So if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, I definitely thought about the solar panel discussion. And you know, what it boils down to, it's that test of whether there really is availability or not, because a lot of people are frustrated with the Betsy program. They're fine with it if they thought it meant that things were made here and installed by people from Oregon in particular. In this case, you know, that makes them feel a lot better about the whole deal. And this would insist that analysis is done. In the end, if they're not available, they're not available, and that's the deal. But I think a lot of people in the public who scrutinize this, I don't think they believe that it's true that there wasn't availability. It was just cheaper and easier to bring in parts from outside the state. On the solar, it's clear that we have the capability to produce and compete against wafers from other countries that we're honoring today, so I won't go into the whole trade disputes. It's clear we have Solar World, we have Sanyo, we have things being produced here, and with public money, public appropriations, public loans, should we have to do an analysis at least to prove it when someone claims they can't get it here, and they prove it through the analysis, and then they can do it? If it's not really true and they just wanted it cheaper, well, that's what hurts our industries. I mean, that's how jobs get outsourced and offshored, and that's what we're, with the money we can control under Interstate Commerce Clause, that's what we ought to be looking at. You know, this isn't designed to tell everybody they got to buy solar panels, you know, from Solar World or Sanyo. But if they're asking for loans and tax credits and things, then we want them to have to look at Oregon products before they start going elsewhere. And if the cost is really that different, 25%, they're out that way as well.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
I agree with what you're saying, Representative, but I guess, again, there are those who would say that if we're going to get the most bang for our Betsies, if you will, the cheaper the price, the more energy efficiency we can provide for the state. So the argument, I guess, could go both ways. But right. Just one other follow-up. Did we see a similar bill like this last session? Something. But there's a word in here that pops my curiosity, and it's the word use. It says iron, steel, or manufactured goods intended for use in the structure. And I think if that's true, we're wondering, how do we define use? Would it mean a Makita drill for use in constructing of the project would be off limits, or do we have to use a Black & Decker? Or are we just simply talking about the infrastructure that goes into the actual facility itself that's a durable good? You know, it wasn't clear last session, as I recall, either, but... You know,
I'm still hung up on trying to remember the bill from last session.
Yeah, doesn't it ring a bell? I mean, just off the record, I think it does. We had something similar last session, but...
no response.
Yeah,
so
I'll have to get that to you. We'll consult, Mr. Chairman, with the legislative counsel.
Yeah.
And maybe the next witness could cover that.
So, pass it back. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and I'm going to let you off the hook with that note, and we'll bring up some other testifiers. Thanks again
much.
For bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to have John Mullis, please. Welcome back. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I want to apologize to the two representatives that were kind enough to come in here and introduce the bill. The way they described it, with the $750,000 and the public-private partnerships and such, is the way we had initially drafted the bill. That is what we would like to see in the long run. But in very recent negotiations with some of the other stakeholders that are interested in this bill, we've agreed to dial it back again to where it would just apply to public improvement contracts only. So we're leaving out some of the more controversial stuff, and then in turn lower the limit to $50,000 to follow the public contracting code. And I again apologize to the two legislators that were up here. We just didn't have the chance to get to them in advance and let them know that. And we've asked for those amendments to be drafted.
So you're not asking for the tax credit changes and
correct.
Those sorts of things in this bill?
That's correct.
With the amendment?
That's correct. So having said that, I'm here to testify in favor, and I'll try and keep this brief because the two representatives were kind enough to give a pretty good overview of the bill. So this would just model the federal act that's currently in existence. We purposely did that to try and get away from any controversy or any issues. It's the same rules that ODOT and other public contracting agencies already follow. It's the same rules that contractors currently follow. It would just extend the coverage into state and funding, state and county funded projects instead of only federal or federal-state mix. And the intent is just to try and incent the use of local manufacturers. We have a great steel manufacturing and fabrication cluster in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and we want to do our best to promote those industries and put people back to work. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the brevity and sticking to the points. Questions for Mr. Mullis? Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Sorry, I know you want to get out of here. So you include counties but not cities. Can you just talk about that decision?
Excuse me, Chair Holby, Representative Kinney-Geyer. I believe it would be all public contracting agencies. That's correct.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We're going to bring up Scott Winkles, Michael Eisen, and Brian Smith next. Welcome, gentlemen, and hopefully you can keep your comments brief as we're quickly running out of time, but I want to make sure you have a chance to offer your support or opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Winkles. I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I'm our lobbyist on all public contracting issues, and I'm appearing in opposition to the bill. In answer to Representative Johnson's question regards to the bill from last session, I remember that one, but I also remember the one from 2010. And what happened then, and that was in one of the first February sessions, Representative Senator Ferger had a similar piece of legislation, and she convened a very large, exhaustive work group to analyze this issue. And we met for many, many hours, over many, many days, over several months, to find a way to move something forward, and we hit several hurdles. During the research, one of the subgroups was led by myself and John Ledger from AOI. We were charged with doing some background research and developing some alternatives. So, this does stick firmly in my memory. But one of the issues that we came up with early on in this process was we found that a similar statute in 1969 had been struck down by the California Court of Appeals, and what that court had ruled was that this was an intrusion in federal territory because of it deals with international relations, and that is a power reserved largely for the federal government. Since 1969, the federal government has entered into the government procurement agreement as part of the WTO, World Trade Organization, and so what we've seen over the past years is larger federal attempts to establish free trade in the area of public improvement. So our estimate from talking to our council at the time was that this would be vulnerable to a challenge, and that challenge would result in significant project delays. That vulnerability would result in cost overruns and significant project problems. Additionally, the bill requires an off-ramp of 25% cost increases in construction costs. It doesn't say material costs, it says in construction costs. So material costs can rise significantly under this legislation before we hit that 25% threshold. And I would remind the committee that we have a public contracting code that has been drafted specifically to design to incentivize and to require, in many cases, least cost projects, so the taxpayer gets the most amount of project for their buck. There are options and methods and construction that are not least cost, but by and large, most of the projects in the state are designed to get at a least cost option, and that has been the policy of the state, and that's the way the contracting code is written.
And thank you. If you could wrap up so I can get the other gentleman on
certainly
the record, please.
Additionally, we also have some concerns about compliance that other members have raised, and with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC is also opposed to this bill, has been for the last several sessions and remains so. We were also part of the exhaustive Senator Verger work group several years ago that Mr. Winkles described, so I won't go into that. Be brief because he raised several of the same concerns we have. Responsibility for compliance, who is responsible for ensuring that the products or components are actually assembled in the United States or are manufactured in the United States. What's the remedy if there's a discovery that a product or component was not produced in the United States? If it's responsibility of the public agency, and a number of these projects are likely to be delayed, potentially for a lengthy period of time. Again, the 25% cost increase before you can go a different direction is a pretty exorbitant cost increase. Even a 20% increase in costs is something that most local governments certainly can't absorb. And again, the inclusion of manufactured goods adds a tremendous amount of complexity to the contracting process. Some manufactured goods may literally contain hundreds of parts, not always sure where those parts are coming from. So with that, I'll close in the interest of time and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Brian Smith, I'm purchasing manager with Multnomah County, and I came on up because these two gentlemen were much more eloquent than I about our opposition to this.
I appreciate you coming up, and thank you very much for your testimony. Sorry about the lack of time for you to expound maybe more that you would like to, but I have one more testifier I wanted to get on the record today. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Last but not least, Drew Hagedorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're a trade association for the commercial construction sector, testifying in opposition to House Bill 2402. We were a part of the work group that was referenced earlier. I would adopt all the arguments that were presented to you there and won't repeat them. Part of the principal purpose for me to come up here today was the verbiage related to public subsidies in Section 2. I understand that will be struck. We would welcome that, but it still doesn't remedy the underlying issues that were addressed by the public contracting agencies. So thank you for your time, and with that, I'm finished.
Yeah, so I'm just going to take liberty and ask one question. I'm just, because I know I followed the Columbia River Bridge, and they have this provision for that, so I'm sort of wondering how it works there, but maybe doesn't work for the, if something similar were designed around that process, would it be able to be implemented at the state level, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. I'm not intimately aware of all the details that were included in the CRC bill. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's an isolated project. It gives us an opportunity to see how that works. This would be a global overarching policy that would be prospective and apply to every state agency. So that's how I would distinguish it.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill. Which one was that? 2402. Committee, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2060. Bob, remind the committee what House Bill 2060 is, and I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2060 is the measure that allows the Attorney General to issue an order disqualifying a charitable organization that fails to expend at least 30% of its expenses on program services, disqualifying them from receiving contributions that are tax deductible. The measure requires a disqualified organization to disclose when soliciting that contributions are not deductible for state income tax purposes and specifies exempt organizations. And the committee will recall that there was adopted a -2 amendment adding a provision eliminating the property tax exemption for an organization that is disqualified from receiving deductible charitable contributions. We have a revenue statement issued that is in OLIS, and the bill has a minimal fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2060 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2060 to the floor with a due pass as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, as you know, I've given a lot of thought to this bill. It's probably not a major bill in the grand scheme of things. And I've talked again to representatives of the Attorney General's office. They seem convinced that this is needed. They know their job better than I do. Sometimes it comes down, in my opinion, to having to trust those that have earned their trust for as long as they've earned it. And so, although I think this is probably an unnecessary bill that is subject to mission creep, nevertheless, I'm going to give them the chance to do what they really think they need. I mean, if the AG is going to go around and lobby for this bill, there must be something in there somewhere that needs to be done. So I'm going to be voting for it.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? No other discussion? Representative Kenny Geyer, we...
Quick comment. No, I think we're going to be the first in the country on this, and I agree that it should be done at the federal level, and I hope it goes in that direction.
Yes, thank you. I've also given this bill a lot of thought as well. I think consumers really deserve to, have some sort of knowledge of what charitable organizations do with their money, and so I think it in that realm does serve a good purpose. So with that, could we have a roll call vote, please, Samantha?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair
Holdy? Aye. The committee would love to put this on the consent calendar, but I'm guessing it probably shouldn't be. Do I have a volunteer for the bill? Representative Kenny Geyer will carry the bill for us. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2060 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government.